This interview is being conducted on August 3rd, 2011 with Mr. Bill Marchetti at the Indian Prairie Library in Darien, Illinois. My name is Deb Barrett. Mr. Marchetti was born on September 28, 1950 in Chicago, Illinois. He is a diesel mechanic for the Chicago Transit Authority and learned of the Veterans History Project through an article about this project in the Darien Patch online newspaper. Mr. Marchetti has kindly consented to be interviewed for this project. Here is his story. Bill, where were you living just before you entered the service? What was your life like?
Well, I was living with my father in Oak Park. My mother died when I was 16, so my sister, who was a newlywed actually, moved into the house to take care of me and my dad. And then they had kids and blah, blah, blah. So anyway, so they had just started having kids. And so I lived in the basement of my sister's house, actually. It was my father's house, but then my sister bought it. And so that's it. That's where I was living when I went into service.
And you were in high school at the time?
I was 16.
You were 16 years old?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And is that the age you were when you went into the service?
Oh, no. I lived there till I was 18.
Okay.
When I graduated from high school, then I didn't do well in high school, but I graduated, and I didn't have good grades for college, and I didn't have any money to go to college anyway. So I knew that I was going to get drafted. And I was very close to getting drafted. I had, already saw this coming. So I decided instead of getting drafted, I would enlist, and then I would get the job I wanted.
So this was like 1968?
1968, yeah.
Okay.
So after, I guess it would have been September of 68 or so, I started thinking about how I was going to do this, what I was going to do. And I decided on the Army because I had talked to the Marines, but I didn't like their program. It just, that's a long story in itself. So anyway, I didn't want to go into the Marine Corps. I actually told a recruiter, I swear to God, it's a true story. I told him, what do you guys know? You guys turned down Audie Murphy. So I didn't want to go into Marines. So I enlisted in the Army to become a mechanic, a diesel mechanic. That's what I wanted to do. That was the trade I had chosen.
Okay.
I was always a tinkerer anyway. So
you signed up for?
I signed up to be a diesel mechanic.
Did your dad, how did he feel about your decision to join?
He supported it, sure. My father was never overbearing like that or anything. I'm sure they were all worried about me.
Right.
I was the baby of the family. So I'm sure they were all worried about me. But, I was in an awkward position there. I wasn't, I wasn't a man. I wasn't a boy. And I had to go out on my own. I had no choice but to do that because my mother was gone, so I was living under my sister's roof, and I didn't want to be in the way, So I thought that was for the best, and I wasn't really worried about that. And so I enlisted, and I went to Fort Leonard Wood for boot camp, and then after boot camp, I went to a leadership school they had, and then I was a squad leader at AIT then.
Okay, well, let's back up a little bit. Where were you inducted?
At Afees downtown in Chicago. You heard of Afees? That's what A-F-F-E-E. I don't know why they called it that, but.
Okay. How long you were inducted there, and then from there you went to Fort Leonard Wood?
Yeah.
What were your first impressions when you went through the induction?
Well, when we took the oath, I was very proud of that, but then when we went to basic, it was, a different story because you got treated like an animal immediately.
Well, what happened when you went to basic? First of all, how did you get to Fort Leonard Wood?
By bus.
Everybody?
By bus, yeah. It's right outside of St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
And, they just took us on a bus and we went there and the next thing you know, they were yelling and screaming at us and throwing clothes at us, you know.
So you were a lot of lines.
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, a lot of lines. Hurry up and wait.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the typical one.
So you got in lines and you got all your stuff. What happened to all your civilian stuff?
Gee, I don't even remember. I think we mailed them home.
Okay.
I think we shipped them home. I guess you could keep a couple of pieces, but I think they had to be stored during basic because they didn't want you to go AWOL on them or whatever, you know.
So right, right.
That stuff had to be put away. But I remember having civilian clothes like 3/4 of the way through basic. We finally like had a Sunday. We could do something on our own, and everybody put civvies on. So somewhere they were there.
Yeah. So what was the... what were your living quarters like when you were in basic?
Oh, I had good living quarters in basic training. They had new buildings that they had just built at Fort Leonard Wood. And the old buildings, like when you came in and you were in, I forget what they called that, when you were getting ready to go into a company, they were old barracks. You had to have a fire watch and everything in them because they were wooden barracks from World War II.
Okay.
And the first few nights were, you know, kind of iffy. Hardly anybody slept because, you know, you didn't know what was going on. There were locals that, you know, would sneak into the compound, you know, and try to mess with people and stuff like that too. It was an awakening, you know. But once we got into basic training, we had real nice billets that were like 3-story high, and they were a brick. And boy, they were really very, very nice, you know. So there was no problem with that. It was just that, you know, they kept you running 24/7 for 6 weeks, you know.
Were you in bunk beds? Was it the long dormitory type of
No. We had
smaller rooms.
We had like 4 or 6-man rooms.
Okay.
And that was it was actually the accommodations were nice, very nice, you know. So, I mean, you had your own lockup area and stuff like that. And but, you know, it was basic training, so everything had to be just right and lined up correctly. And, you know, you couldn't.
So even your locker, everything had to be a certain way?
Oh, sure, yeah. They were real sticklers for stuff like that because they wanted to. You know, the military program is break you down till you think you're nothing and build you back up until you think you're something.
Right.
That's what they do to you. So and that's what they do. They get you to do everything the same way as everybody else, so that you become you understand what a team does. So it works. It's a terrific thing. So I think it's a good thing. I didn't have a problem transitioning to that because I was a Boy Scout, you know.
Uh-huh.
And so I like camping and stuff like that. So I didn't have a problem with anything like that. No, I like.
So was this your first time away from home by yourself?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Was there anyone you knew who was also there at the same time? Any friends from home?
No, I didn't know anybody there. But a lot of those guys, you know, you get close to people right away.
Right.
Yeah. I could tell you a story. I swear this is true. A guy I was in basic training with, when they had the welcome home parade.
Mm-hmm.
On Navy Pier, I was standing in line at Navy Pier behind this guy, and I recognized him from the back.
Really?
I looked, because
this was
like
1990?
I think it was 90, no, I think it was 87 or,
okay.
I changed jobs in 88, it was like 86, 87. And that was when they had the Welcome
right.
Home Parade. And I'm standing in line, they just put everybody in line. And I'm standing behind this guy, and I look at his, between his ears, and I went, Pollock? His name was Don Pollock, and we called him Pollock. And he turned around, and he looked at me, and they called me WAP, you know, because I'm Italian. And that, and he went, turned around, he goes, you recognize me from the back of my head? I said, I swear to God, I knew it was you. I knew it was you. That's, you know.
So there's a lot of close bonding.
Yeah, he was a good kid too. Yeah.
So what was a typical day like in your base camp?
In base camp, or basic training?
Basic
training was just running.
What time did you get up?
Like 5 a.m, they'd roust you.
And gently, I know.
Oh, yeah. No. It was all banging and running, you know. And the drill sergeants were, we didn't have drill sergeants, we had drill instructors. No, the Marine Corps had drill instructors, we had drill sergeants. And don't call them drill instructor or you'd get your butt kicked. But I remember the very first day we ran, and everybody was falling out. We had it was winter time, it was very cold, then it was Missouri in the winter. And Missouri, you know, had weird weather. It could get real hot during the day, and then it'd be freezing at night. But anyway, they fall out, and we're you know, all green, and we're trying to this, and they start us running, and guys are buckling over and falling. And I was running, and I was saying, no, I'm not going to fall. And I go, oh, I can't run. I can't run. My side was killing me. I swear, I thought I was going to fall out. And just when I was going to, another kid laid down on the grass, and the DI ran right up to him and kicked him.
Really?
Yeah. And I went, oh, I'm not doing that. And I ran, and I kept running. So I learned that lesson. You know, you didn't want to get beat up, so... You know, it's a different army today, right, than we were in. They were not afraid to manhandle you, and that's what you did, you know.
So you made the whole run?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, made that run. But, you know, there were a lot of others that I suffered through, you mm-hmm. know. But that's okay. That's part of growing up, too, you know.
So you went, you get up in the morning, 5 o'clock. Yeah. Did you eat before you exercised?
No. You ran and you did PT. Then you ate. Then you either did more PT or they did training. You know, marching was a big thing because you had to learn how to march. If you didn't learn how to march, you wouldn't be cohesive with each other. So you had to learn how to march, and it was a comedy of errors. They would get you marching and it became like an accordion where everybody from the back was walking into the front guys until everybody learned to, hey, wait, take a step, you know. And I mean, seriously, it was comical, but guys got hurt,
right,
because people would bump heads. You know, they really, these accordions became long, and you know, and you'd see that it was stretching out, and you'd be going, oh, no, this ain't going to happen, you know. But we learned right away.
And how many guys would be in one of these accordions?
There'd be 50 guys in a platoon. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was kind of dangerous, really. You know, they ran you. Then they taught you to force march, walk fast,
uh-huh,
and then we would run in formation too. Once you learned how to walk in a formation, things got ultimately, you know, easier.
Right.
You know, infinitely easier. So.
And what kind of classes did you have? What sort of things did they teach you?
Well, basic training. It was just basic infantry classes. You know, everybody's job number one is infantry. That's mm-hmm. what you're trained. So we did map reading. We did compass skills.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those are things that I already kind of knew because like I say, I was in Boy Scouts. And, you know, so we did that kind of stuff. There was a lot of things, you know. We went, we had to do rifle training. We had to learn how to clean a rifle. And, you know, we used M14s
mm-hmm.
when I went through training. But then we changed over when I went to AIT, we went to 16s. I don't know why we weren't trained with the 16 to begin with, but I come to believe that the M14 was a much better weapon.
Was this the first time you'd used a gun, or had you used one at...
I had gone hunting when I was
okay.
a kid. You know, my mother's family lived in Iowa, and they were all farmers, so
okay.
we would go hunting and fishing. But I was never big into guns, you mm-hmm. know. I like guns now, but mm-hmm. that's because, I don't know.
Okay.
I got older, you know. But the training was pretty good, I thought, actually, you know.
And how long was your basic training?
I think it was 8 weeks, if I remember right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Were you able to call home, write home, see packages?
Not at first. Yeah, you could get mail all the time.
Okay.
You could get mail, but you couldn't get packages until like the third or fourth week.
Okay.
And it all depended if, you know, if you were in good graces or not, you know.
You could write to them too, or?
Can you hold on a minute? Again, I don't know why.
So you had 8 weeks.
Yeah, 8 weeks of basic training.
You were able to communicate with home after the first week or so?
After the first few weeks.
Few weeks?
Yeah, you could always write letters, you could, they were never, you know, stopping you from writing letters, but they didn't really want you to, you know, it's like a cult, you know, they want to separate you from your family and keep you captive. So they're brainwashing you anyway, and that's was what the program was, there's no doubt about that, you know.
Did you have any free time?
No.
None?
No, not for the first, as I recall, not for the first month or so.
Okay.
You know, yeah, we were busy every day doing something every day, and we trained 7 days a week. We didn't have days off until maybe the third or fourth week. Then we finally got a day where they gave us like a Sunday.
And what did you do with that time?
Ran to the phones, you know. That's what, that's all, you know, and called home and say, hey, how are you, you know.
Did you go into town at all?
Oh, no, they wouldn't let us off the base.
You had to stay on the base.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. When you're in basic training, you're a maggot, you know. So that was what they were trying to instill in you, you know. So you were grateful just to get to, you know, call home, yeah.
So when you completed your basic training, did they have any kind of ceremony or anything?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, they had a whole deal with it, you know. It was, I got a picture.
Was your family able to join you?
When I graduated? Yeah, actually, when I graduated from basic training, my father and my oldest sister came there, and then we went to St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember, you know, that's funny. So there's something you said you don't remember that. But a guy bought me dinner.
A guy just?
Yeah, just somebody in a restaurant.
Saw you in uniform?
Yeah. Yeah, he bought me dinner.
Okay.
So I thought that was kind of cool.
That was, yeah.
Yeah. So people cared then, you know.
So when you finished your basic and you graduated, did you get any leave time or?
No. I had to, like I said, I got picked to be a squad leader for AIT, which is Advanced Individual Training.
Okay.
So that's the next phase of basic.
You know, so the you next went from 8 weeks. Straight to into.
I went to this leadership school. It was called.
And that was at.
That was at Fort Leonard Wood, yeah. Okay. It was a 2 week class, and it was all STRAC stuff, you know, keep your bunk straight and all of that, like an OCS type thing.
Well, like officer candidate training, right?
Yeah, and you know, they made you wear a helmet liner and all this crazy stuff. Anyway, so I went through that and I brushed it off basically because it was just, you know, more military, you know, junk, you know what I mean? So anyway, then when I went into AIT, though, I was a squad leader then.
Okay.
So I had a squad of guys that came to me. I was the mother hen. I had to go to the DI if anybody had a problem. That was
the drill sergeant?
Yeah. So.
Okay.
And anyway, and that's all that was. It was I got a few stories from AIT that was pretty strange. If you want me to go on them, I can. About the sixth or seventh week of AIT. Now we're learning to do mechanics, you know, and so it's more like a school. Every day is a school. You still do PT and stuff like that, but it's just that basically you're going to school.
Mm-hmm.
So you do have time on your own after hours. So anyway, it was a Sunday, and we had to clean the orderly room. So they told us the orderly room will close. You'll close the orderly room at 4 o'clock or whatever. So I said to the guys, mind you, now we weren't able to go drinking or anything like that, but the class ahead of us, they were off on that Sunday. So they were using the orderly room or the day room, and they were playing pool and stuff in there, and they had gone and had a couple of pops, and you know.
Mm-hmm.
So they were feeling their oats because they were ready to graduate, and we were a week behind them. And anyway, so I says to the other guys, I says, I'm going to go tell them that the day room's closing. And so you guys mosey over there in about 10 minutes and we'll clean it up because that was our duty. So it's okay. They were all good kids. So I went over there and I walked in and I'm just watching them play pool. And so I said, and they were all cocky and snotty about things. You know, they didn't know me and, you know, who am I to tell them anything? I'm a lower classman or whatever. And the kid says to me, what do you want? I said, we're going to close the day room's going to close so we can clean it up. And he goes, oh, yeah, well, we're not leaving. So I said, well, you're going to leave because we're going to close it. And as I said that, one of them threw a cup at me, a paper cup, and it hit the wall. And I bent down to go get it. And when I did, the guy swung the pool cue at me like that. But, you know, he didn't grow up in my neighborhood, this guy, because he swung it with the small end towards me instead of swinging the big end at me. And so I caught it. And I flipped him right on the pool table, and I beat him with the stick. But what the best part was the whole squad walked in the door right when the guy swung the stick at me, so that held everybody else off. And I wound up beating the crap out of him. He was a big American Indian kid. He was gigantic. They called him Chief. And so I wound up beating this guy up. And I mean, I heard him, but he was big and he didn't want to stop and he was drinking. So anyway, I hurt the guy. I didn't mean to, but I did. And so right away, you know, here's the officer of the day is there. What's going on? You know, well, I'm on duty, sir. You know, the guy tried to hit me with a pool cue. I defended myself. Well, it was like, you know, oh, okay, you know, well, you're in the right because you were on duty. You know, they should have listened to you. They should have obeyed the order. Well, long story short, the next morning I fall out. I ran into the guy as he had to go back to the orderly room. But my guys are with me and he's alone now because his guys have abandoned him. And he's going, oh, man, what are you going to say in there? What are you going to say in there? He's saying to me. He goes, Bud, you're going to do all the talking. I'm not saying nothing. You know, this is not my battle. You know, you're the one who screwed up, not me. So anyway, the officer today got a chuckle out of it anyway. But he knew that guy was going to be written up for something. And the next day, I had to go give blood. And while I was giving blood, my drill sergeant and the CO walk in the room, and my drill sergeant says, "Hey, Mark, you want to fight, huh? You like fighting?" And the CO stand there with him, and he says, "No, well, we could maybe do something about that." And I said, "Well, I don't know what you mean, sir. You know what do you mean?" He goes, well, you know, we might have an opening in Vietnam for you. I says, oh, no, sir. I'm supposed to go to Fort Knox for track school. You know, I told him. Well, 2 weeks later, I got orders for Nam. And when I complained about it, because I said, wait a minute, now, I enlisted for track school.
Right.
They told me, oh, don't worry. You're going to get track school. OJT track school. Yeah. Out of job training. So because I did my job too good, I wound up getting sent to Nam,
right,
over getting the schooling that I wanted, you know. So that left me a little bitter when I first got to Nam. Then I kind of had the case of the jaws about that, you know, because I wouldn't have cared if I had to go to Nam. Mm-hmm. It was just that I had a contract, you know, and they didn't live up to it.
Right.
You know. But so, I think the fight.
You think that kind of had something to do with it?
Yeah. But I swear to God, I was only defending myself.
Yeah.
You know. So but they didn't know how Chicagoans were. You know.
So when, how much time did you have when you found out you were going to Vietnam? I mean.
Oh, it was only, I probably got a maybe a 2-week leave.
Wow. You did get a leave then?
Yeah, yeah, but it was only like 15 days or something like that. Because I think, because I had gone to that class, I was like an odd cycle or something.
Okay.
So instead of getting 30 days, I only got 15 or something like that. It was, I forgot how that worked.
Okay. But, were most of the guys in your platoon going there? No,
they went all over the place.
Okay.
Guys went everywhere. Most of those guys, I don't think I've ever seen anybody from AIT again.
Okay.
You know, but that was like the highlight of AIT.
Right. So going to...
I didn't mean to tell that story.
That's all right. So going to, you know, enlisting in the Army was one thing when your family knew you were going to Vietnam.
Well, I you know what? I don't know how they ever took that.
Okay.
You know, I really didn't. I came home and I had I kind of surprised them when I came home because it was like spur of the moment type thing.
Oh, you didn't tell them you were coming?
No, I didn't. I don't know why. I just
How
didn't.
Did you get home?
I don't remember. I must have taken a bus.
Okay.
Must have taken a bus. I flew. I had to fly because you would fly standby.
Okay.
Sheesh, I don't remember that particular trip. Other ones, I remember flying home and, you know.
Right.
I remember when I came home from Nam the first time, the second time. I took a cab because I didn't want anybody to know I was coming home because the first time the neighbors were all out there and everything, and it freaked me out. You know, it was nice. Don't get me wrong. And you know, they were supportive, but I didn't want to go through that again.
Yeah. So you flew home, or
yeah.
Took a bus or flew home.
Yeah. We're still talking about after AIT.
So 15 days.
15 days ahead.
And then where did you have to go?
I think I had to go to Fort Dix, I think.
Okay.
New Jersey.
And you flew there?
So, yeah, I had to fly there. And you flew standby.
Uh-huh.
You know, because it was cheaper. And I think I had a voucher to fly.
Okay.
But you flew standby, so you didn't bump anybody, you know.
Right.
Only if there were openings.
So this was still 1968?
1960. No, this 69? Would have been. This would have been 68. Now, 68 would have been, I think April.
April 68. Okay.
Yeah. It was April or May. I started basic training right. I was the first cycle of the year. So I went there like December 27th, but didn't start basic till like January 3rd or something like that.
Were you the only serviceman on that flight? Were there others in uniform on that flight?
Oh, I'm sure there were. Oh, yeah, I'm sure there were.
Okay.
Yeah, because it would have come from Missouri to just a
right.
home, you know.
Any reaction from people?
No.
Okay.
People were not the... Like today, you know, people are supportive today.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my mission in life right now, is to make sure these guys are welcomed home.
Because that was... 68, 69, that was a rough time in our
history. Wasn't so bad yet.
Uh-huh.
When I actually came home from Vietnam,
that was
crummy.
Okay.
That was crummy. Not my neighbors. My neighbors were good.
So you had a flight to Fort Dix.
Yeah.
And how were you prepared to go to Vietnam? What did they tell you? What did they give you?
They gave us nothing. They sat us around. They gave us a book that said, tour. This is your tour. And it had like a 5-second blurb about, what the rice bowl was. And, all of Southeast Asia is a rice bowl. That's how they feed the rest of the Asian community. And Vietnam's a big feeder of Southeast Asia. It's all rice. I mean, the whole place is rice fields. And they gave you a little bit about the culture, but we had absolutely no training about speaking the language or anything like that. We didn't really get anything about what to expect when we get there. You know, we weren't taught, what the weather was going to be like. You know, we were issued warm weather fatigues and stuff like that, so you figured it's going to be tropical, you know.
Right.
You didn't think it was going to be 140 degrees, you know. But it was, you know, I was completely and utterly unprepared for what I ran into.
Had you seen any of the news on TV about what was happening in Vietnam? Had any of that really
registered with you? Oh, yeah, sure. I remember seeing the Buddhist monks burning themselves. Mm-hmm. I saw that. But for the most part, you know, I had been in training for 6 months, you know, so I didn't really have a lot of time to see that there.
Right, you were kind of cut off from seeing that.
Yeah, but I knew that there was a war going on. You know, I wasn't a fool. I knew what was going on. But I hadn't really given that a lot of thought. My thought was I'm going to be a track mechanic. I'm not going to be involved in that.
You're not going to be in combat.
You know, yeah. When I had never actually planned on that, you know. But
so
things change you.
Yeah. So how long was your flight? You had to make a connection somewhere?
Oh, yeah, several. So it was odd because, I went back and forth 4 times, so every time I went a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And it was always a commercial jet, and there were stewardesses and everything on mm-hmm. the planes. They were nice, but they were all GIs, you know, and we knew we were going to Vietnam. But one time I flew out of Fort Dix, and I went to Ireland, and I didn't go to Germany. Where did I go? Went from Ireland, I think, to Iceland,
okay.
And then from Iceland to Hawaii. I don't know how it worked. No, it was Tokyo. I think it was Tokyo.
Okay.
And then from Tokyo to Vietnam.
Right.
Then another time I went, one time I remember I went through Alaska and Hawaii on the same trip. And I couldn't for the life of me figure out how did we do that, you know? But, one time you flew off the West Coast, one time you flew off the East Coast, or maybe it was coming back the other way. I don't remember. I can't remember. But just the strangest things, you know. I always said I saw the whole world, but I was everywhere for 45 minutes, you know, because that's what you do when you travel, you know.
So how did you pass the time on the trip to Vietnam, that first trip?
Jeez. I can't even remember.
Were you nervous? Were you?
No, I wasn't nervous until I got there. And the only reason why I was nervous when we got there was because the guys who greeted the plane played a game on us.
What did they do?
Well, they run in with their guns drawn, and we don't have any weapons now, you know. And, okay, we took rockets 2 hours ago, and we're going to take rockets again. We know we're going to get hit. When you get out of the plane, you know, you got to run across the runway, blah, blah, blah. You know, they're laying all this crap on you, and you know, it's hot there. So I remember when they opened the door of that airplane, that heat hit you like somebody punched you in the face, and all of a sudden your mind wasn't working. And then you got people yelling at you, telling you, you know, that, oh my God, you know, find cover when you get out of the airplane, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden, the next thing you know, you're standing in the middle of the tarmac and there's nothing going on. It's, you know, they think they're being funny because they got too much time on their hands, you know. But if some of those guys ever did go to the field, they would have felt a little differently about playing a game on newbies. You know,
so when you went to Vietnam the first time, where did you land? Where did you first come into the country?
Tan Son Nhut Air Base, I think it was.
Okay.
Which is just outside of Saigon.
Okay.
And a lot of people came in through Cam Ranh Bay, which was another place that they came in. I came in through Tan Son Nhut. Why, I don't know.
Okay.
But probably because I was going to be stationed in the Iron Triangle, and so that was where that was.
And the Iron Triangle was...
Yeah. Iron Triangle is the area around Saigon.
Okay.
That was fortified. Kind of, you heard of the Green Zone in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, it's kind of like that, but the Green Zone's base camp.
And there were three.
There were three major bases in the Iron Triangle on all three corners.
Okay.
But the rest of it was open jungle, you know, mm-hmm. in between there. So like I'm saying, they were probably, I guess, 15 or 30 miles apart, you know, around Saigon.
Right.
So.
Okay. Well, once you realized that they pulled this joke on you.
Oh, you know, we were pretty ticked off, but there was nobody to yell at about it because they were gone.
Yeah.
You know.
When you looked around, what was your impression of what you saw?
It was just hot. It was just hot. It was really ungodly hot. And we were on an airport, you know.
In a tarmac, which is hotter.
Yeah. And then somebody says, okay, well, you guys can go eat, you know. And I remember that like it was yesterday. So we're all in line, you know. Well, we got to eat, you know, got to eat something. But, you know, who wants to eat? It's so hot. And we got in line, and we were along what they call a piss ditch.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just garbage in this ditch. And we all got there, and everybody was heaving because it was so hot, and, you know, and I can't eat, you know. And it was just horrible. It was horrid. But finally, they pushed us into some bunk somewhere, you know, a rack, and so we just laid around and waited for somebody to come get us to go do something, you know.
And so what were your living accommodations like there then?
Well, they were okay. There was just, as I recall, it was fairly clean. Mm-hmm. You know, that was, Tansanoot and Longbin were large, large base camps.
Mm-hmm.
And they were pretty much stateside, like, you know.
Right.
I mean, they had streets that had names and things like
right.
that, you know. You never saw that out in the small base camps, you know. So anyway, as I recall, I think they moved us from there into as they were getting us ready to go to wherever we were going to be. They put us on a bus. I remember that, and it was nighttime. And they drove us through Saigon, the outskirts of Saigon, which I didn't know it was the outskirts of Saigon at the time. I come to find that out a year later when I was in that same area just in a Jeep one time.
Mm-hmm.
So I says, wow, I remember going down the streets, you know. But they had us in these buses with cages on the side because, again, we didn't have any weapons and they were moving us. And so to keep them from fragging us or whatever, as we went through the town, they had us in these caged buses. And you're just driving through and you see, what the hell did I get myself into there? You know?
And could you hear was it quiet? Could you hear
it was like gunfire? No. It was like a bustling little town.
Okay.
You know, Saigon's a big town.
Right.
It's not a small place. And like I say, though, this was an outskirt.
Mm-hmm.
And you saw like little outposts up on hills and
uh-huh.
stuff like that, like little pillboxes. And you say, wow, well, you know, that's interesting. There's a town right here, but they got weapons sitting up here, you know. And, you know, do they get shot at over here? You know, what goes on? You know, it makes you wonder.
Right.
But like I said, I was a new guy then, and I didn't really know, you know, what to expect.
Mm-hmm.
And having had them play the game on us at first,
no.
I was not, you know, I was thinking, hey, this is a bunch of crap, you know, so.
So, and you were 19 this
19,
time?
Yeah, I was 19.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, how long were you?
I think you had to be 19 to go to Vietnam.
Okay.
If you were 18, I don't think they would have sent you, but I could be wrong about that.
Okay. So you were at this base for how long?
That was maybe 3-4 days.
Yeah. Okay.
You know.
And then from there, where were you sent?
Then they sent me to Black Horse Base Camp, which is the opposite way from Bear Kit.
Okay.
The opposite side of the triangle.
Okay.
And they put me with the 11th Armored Cav.
Mm-hmm.
And my job was to be a track mechanic.
Okay.
Okay, now, I didn't know anything about tracks or diesels because I didn't...
You didn't get the school.
I didn't get schooling. Right, but I was on the job training. So anyway, they put us in this base camp, and it was not a really, really small base camp, but there were probably maybe 400 people on
okay.
Black Horse. And And I really, actually, I like Black Horse because we were pretty much left alone. We didn't have to play army, you know, but we had to pull a lot of duty because, you know, we were non-combat
right.
soldiers. So when you're non-combat, that means that you pick up the slack for what the grunts have to do.
Right.
So that meant you had to pull. But we had to pull our own KP anyway. Mm-hmm. So that was one duty. But I only had to do that for a short time because I was already PFC. So
okay.
So the E2s had to do that. But everybody made PFC going into NAM.
Okay.
Okay, but I had made PFC out of basic training.
So you had more seniority.
Because of the schooling.
Right.
Not seniority, just rank,
yeah.
You know. So anyway, so when I only had to do that for a short time, but then I had to pull... they had charge of quarters, which was there would be an officer of the day and a CQ, they called them, and then there would be a runner, and so you would either be the runner or you'd be the CQ, whatever they needed the post filled, and you'd have to work like you'd work through the night, and you'd bring messages back and forth to people and stuff like that, all kinds of things to do when you were CQ. It was amazing the crap you had to do for that. We did that the entire time I was in the Army. We always had CQ duties. But then we had to pull guard duty. Mm-hmm. And we had to pull guard duty every third day. This is besides, you know, doing our job, you
right.
know, which was staging tracks. But anyway, everybody rotated the duty. So you'd pull guard duty every third day. And then every other guard duty, you'd have to pull what they call tower guard. Guard duty was the overnight guard mm-hmm. shift, like a 12-hour shift. But tower guard was a 24-hour shift, and you had to work in four-hour increments, and you'd sit up in a tower.
One of those towers you had seen and wondered about?
Yeah, one of those towers I saw and wondered about, yeah. But the way the berm would be set up always was there'd be five or six bunkers and then a tower.
Okay.
And then five or six bunkers and a tower, and the camo would go to the tower from the bunkers so that they knew everybody was awake, you know,
okay.
more or less. So you'd have to call in and say, you know, if it was your watch, you know, you'd have to call in and say, this is bunker 872, whatever it is. And, you know, we have a negative sit rep at this time, which is a negative situation report. Okay. But if you had movement, or if you saw fire, or if you had anything unusual, you
mm-hmm.
know, which, I mean, you know, you could have mongooses running over you, you know what I mean? It's the jungle. There's a lot of weird things out there. So you'd call in and you'd tell them, I got movement here, you know. So
then
somebody would come out and look at things with you, you know, and they'd tell you, okay, you know, if you took fire, you could return fire.
Mm-hmm.
But that very seldom ever happened because the VC wouldn't want to challenge us. We were well armed, you know. So they would try to breach your wire a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
And if they did, well, you'd blow. We had these 55-gallon drums out there. It's called foo gas. And you hit one of them. Most of the time they had holes in them already. They wouldn't blow up. But if they were filled, they'd explode and it would light up the whole area. And if somebody was out there, you were going to see
them,
you know, because everything was defoliated, you know, mm-hmm. they had already used Agent Orange. It was common practice. So the berm was burnt down, you know, you could see, and it was all barbed wire, like 8 or 10 strings of barbed wire before that, you know, and then before you'd go into for guard duty, you'd go out and check your wiring to claymores and everything.
Mm-hmm.
You had fortifications.
To the claymore mines?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah. And then when you hear people tell you that the VC would turn them around on you, they would do that. So you'd always have to go check. That's why it was written right on there, toward enemy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you put them down that way.
Did you ever, while you were on duty there, did you ever see anything or have any of these experiences?
Yeah, a few times. Actually, you know, more times we were closer to having friendly fire incidents than actually having firefights. Because we had so much firepower. I mean, we had a lot of firepower, and it was easy to make mistakes. Right. We had a second lieutenant one night called in a mortar strike, and he called it in on our own bunker, on one of our own bunkers, and we wound up going out and digging the guys out of the bunker by hand, and thank God everybody was okay. It hit right before the bunker and buried the bunker, you know, and it's red sand, red clay, and you know, we were like all freaked out, you know, there's, you know, 40 of us digging through the dirt. And when we came up with the guys, they were okay. They were just covered with dirt. That was, you know, that was one of those instances where, you know, you dumbass, you know, you're not, you're too green, you know what I mean? You don't know what you're doing. You gotta look at those maps, you know. So anyway, stuff like that did happen, but most of the time we didn't have too many incidents, and because they didn't really want to challenge us. We had really good defenses.
Mm-hmm.
So they liked to mortar us, you know. We took a lot of mortars, some rockets. We were right outside of a town called Swan Lock. And in Swan Lock, there was an orphanage that nuns ran.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the VC actually lobbing mortars on that because they didn't like the Christians.
Okay.
You know, now they killed kids.
Yeah.
You know, how is that, you know, these are your people. You know, from an American's point of view, we looked at that and said, you know, we ought to blast these guys because these guys are animals. I mean, they're killing their own people, you know, little kids, you know, orphans already. They haven't had enough, you know, they haven't had enough bad stuff happen to them.
So it made you more determined, not less determined.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. So anyway.
So you were doing this tower duty.
Yeah.
And you were working on the trucks and stuff.
Right, right.
How long did you do that type of?
I did that for about 4 months.
Okay.
And then they decided to move us.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they convoyed us out of Bearcat, out of Black Horse.
Okay.
And we went to Bearcat,
okay,
which is where I joined the 240th. But the the reason they moved us was because they were turning Black Horse over to the Arvins,
the Army
of the Republic of Vietnam.
Right.
So we turned that over to them, and the night that we got to Bearcat, we stood on the berm at Bearcat and watched the mortar Black Horse, and we counted 66 rounds that they put on there, that the VC put in there just to show the Arvins, you know, that they were going to be a force to be reckoned with.
Right.
You know, I don't think that would have happened if we had been there, because we would have blown the hell out of them. I mean,
right.
But you know, they wanted to prove a point.
Right.
You know. So the Arvins some of them were good soldiers. Arvin Marines were good soldiers. Montagnards were good soldiers. Arvin Special Forces were good soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
But the normal Arvin troop was a farm kid that got pressed into duty, and he really did not want to be there.
Right.
You know. So they were a little lax in discipline, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And as I learned later, you know, I got to really distrust them when we went to the field with them, because we would have to literally throw them out of the aircraft when we'd come into an LZ. They wouldn't get out. And if you're sitting there hovering, you're just a target.
Right.
So, you know, something's got to give. So I never played around. I would literally take them and throw them out of the aircraft.
Yeah, get onto the ground and do what you're supposed
never
to do.
Never had to do that with any other soldiers that we dealt with. Ties, I supported ties. I supported tons of American units. Never, ever with an American unit do we ever have to go through anything like that. Rocks,
you know, Koreans, Filipinos, Australians. Nobody else do we ever have to do that. But with Arvins, we always had to do that. And not with Arvin Marines or not with special forces. They were better. But the regular Arvin grunts.
Regular conscripts, the ones who were pressed into service.
They were just regular GIs, but they weren't very good soldiers. Really weren't.
So this is when you were at Bearcat?
This was when we went to Bearcat. We moved to Bearcat.
Right. And so your job there was what?
I was still a track mechanic. But we had supported the 25th Infantry and I think the 9th Infantry there, and the 11th Cav had gone on to Cambodia.
Okay.
Then we had a stand down because of the Cambodian push. And so we worked like I think it was like, I don't know, 5 or 6 days getting stuff together to go into Cambodia.
Okay.
And we nobody slept. We worked our tails off. And we got all this stuff done, and actually got an Army Commendation Medal for it. But we put all that together, and they had the first Cambodian campaign. And I didn't have to go to Cambodia, but I did all that staging.
Right.
And about that time, they started sending me to the field then to get tracks and stuff out of the field, and that was not a good job. You know, most of the time we couldn't get them out of the rice paddies. You know, these guys would drive these things into dikes and they'd be stuck in there. So we'd go out there and we'd try to get them out. And I remember one time we had a skyhook come in, you know, big guy, Sikorsky.
Okay.
You know,
right.
It looks like a bumblebee, but right. They're gigantic, big tires, and they came down on the APC, and it was just an APC that was stuck in mud, and they grabbed it with the winch and they broke the seal, you know, the mud seal, in the water.
Right.
And I started the thing up and I was trying to run it up the side of the dike, and I got up to the top of the dike and it slid right back down into the water again. And then I tried again, and then they picked up the helicopter, and they, like, nudged me and, you know, got it up on the top of the thing, but it slid back down again. Finally, you know, I said, you know, we're going to drown here, you know. And you know, believe it or not, they sent us, I wasn't a combat soldier at that time, but they sent us there without weapons because they said, well, you're a mechanic. What do you need a weapon for? You know, we want you to get the track out. So we're trying to get the track out. It was, you know, utterly ridiculous. And then we had 10-ton wreckers that we would put the cables out on them, and we put them on them, and we try to drag them out with those. We had cables break, and we lost an infantryman one day because the cable snapped and went over the truck and hit him across the back of the neck.
Oh, wow.
And killed him.
Yeah.
And so I said, well, that ain't working, you know. This is ridiculous. A lot of times when we couldn't do that, we would just implode them with the magnesium.
Destroy them.
Yeah, we just blow them up. It was just senseless. So what are we gonna do? We can't get it back. Oh, we lost a lot of them. Yeah, when they were stuck in mud, Vietnam is all rice paddies,
right.
But there's a monsoon season. When there's monsoon season, it's relentless. It rains every day at the same time. You know that it's coming. But it's harsh. So you know this isn't going to happen. You know, you're not going to get this thing out of here. So why waste time with it? In the meantime, you know, they could be mortaring you. And you don't even know where the hell that's coming from. So you say, no, this is ridiculous. Why am I playing this game?
Right.
You know, so I got tired of that immediately, you know. Luckily, I didn't have to do that all the time, but every time that I had to go do that, I just really did not want to go to the field.
Right.
That. So anyway, because we had dealt with that Sikorsky, and that one time talked to the pilots, you know, this and that. And they said, oh, you guys should volunteer to fly. And I thought, well, I don't know, fly. You know, it'd be kind of cool to fly. And so we were right across the street from the flight line that they had the picture of, mm-hmm. that flight line. So I went, I was talking to another warrant officer over there. And he goes, well, if you want to fly, I'll give you a set of Nomex. All you got to do is just get the okay from your CO to, go. A set of Nomex, you know, flight uniform.
Okay.
They're fireproof.
Okay.
So this is okay. So I had to put tape over his name and his rank, you know. And I like a, new guy, okay. But I already been in country, 5 months. I was not a new guy. And so I went and I flew one day. And they put me in the command ship. That's what, and I didn't know that this was how they broke everybody in, you know. But anyway, I flew as the door gunner on the command ship, which means I was on the right side in the gunwale. But it was the command ship. So what it did was it circled the AO, the area of operation, and it called all the shots on what was going to happen. So like when they were going to have when they were going to insert troops, they'd call the slicks in. The slicks would bring the troops in. They would do a combat assault, and you got to watch the combat assault, and everybody blew everything up and landed in the in here, and they inserted the troops, and then they left, and then you flew around in a circle, and you knew that the troops were down here, and then you'd call in airstrikes when they would want airstrikes or. The gunships were always around, mm-hmm. and the gunships would cover our own aircraft and the troops, So if they needed air power, you went there, you covered that. So it was kind of like, wow, this is pretty cool. I'm up here watching the war, And I'm listening to the radio, so I know everything is going on. I thought, this is really cool, So I was sold on this, Never thinking that, I'm going to be one of them guys.
I'm not going to be listening.
Yeah. So anyway, but you always got the radio. And the radio, everybody heard what was going on. That was what was really nice was you had your own inner communication in your aircraft. And then you had the outside communication. And you, the guys inside, you'd have to change the channel to talk to the outside. Which we barely ever did, but mm-hmm. If we were shot down, we needed SOS. We knew where to go. But anyway, so I flew that one time, and I said, "This is the greatest thing in the world, and I get to shoot back." I thought, really thought that. So I said, "I'm gonna do it." So I put in the transfer, but what I had to do is I had to extend my tour. Now, so I'd already been there 5 months. I had 7 months left to serve. So I got to go home. I went home for 30 days. Mm-hmm. And then I came back as a door gunner. So I didn't have to pull any more duties. And I thought it was much better duty in that I didn't have to pull any duties.
So you went home for 30 days and then came back to this new...
Job. Right. But to the 240th Assault Helicopter.
And was this winter, summer?
Sheesh. That would have been 5 months ago. It would have been April, May, June, July, August. Would have been September.
Okay.
September is probably just getting into the hot season.
Okay.
I would think.
So you came home, probably felt a whole lot cooler at home than. You said you had 30 days.
Yeah, you had 30
just
days.
Just relax. How were people responding to you back home?
Nobody really knew. Okay. Nobody really knew. And I didn't try to explain nothing to anybody. I didn't.
Right.
You know what I mean? I was a true believer in the war mm-hmm. because, like I told you, when I saw them bomb women and children.
Right.
We get a bad rap about that all the time, Mile High and that mm-hmm. whole thing. But the truth is that most of us were very, very well disciplined.
Right.
And we did not do things like that. There were several incidents of friendly fire both ways.
Right.
But that wasn't necessarily on purpose.
Right.
If I could say something here,
yeah.
As far as my lie goes, mm-hmm. my whole take on my lie, and I wasn't a ground pounder.
Right.
But I dealt with a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I know, and I medevaced a lot of your guys. And when the VC would take prisoners, they were big into maiming and cutting off body parts and putting them up on display for their buddies to find, especially when they were going into a new ville.
Right.
You know, and so these guys were already PO'd when they got into the village.
Mm-hmm.
And so anything that set them off, you know, was reason enough.
Sort of like the perfect storm.
Exactly. But they did that, you know, the VC did that on purpose
mm-hmm.
to put them in that frame of mind.
Right.
And probably they knew that this village is more friendly than they would like it to be, but not as good as they would like it to mm-hmm. be, you know. So they let those people be the guinea pigs.
Right.
It was a you know, that's the horrible thing about war. I mean, you know, everybody hides their guns in churches.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything is always, you know, not what it seems. So, you know, I don't blame some guys for some of the things that they did. I'm not condoning it, but
you can understand.
But I can understand it, and especially if I found my friend, you know. Decapitated
right.
and hanging like John the Baptist.
Right.
You know, I wouldn't have thought twice of killing somebody.
Right.
I mean, really.
Right.
Let's face it. That's human nature. So anyway, but we're lucky we didn't run into that kind
yeah.
of thing.